Okay, now I'm rolling. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm just going to read out the bit of the consent form which talks about the actual project. So the GRC story is a project comprising archival and oral history research. It aims to engage current Londoners with the story of the GRC before its abolition. By retelling the history of the institution and its relationships to communities and social movements of the time, we hope to inspire people to think more creatively about the possibilities of city-level democracy. So that's one of the main reasons why this project exists in itself. The reason I wanted to talk to you was because, well, first, I don't know, maybe you should say who you are. And
what I was in?
In the GRC.
Yeah. Now, my name's Tony Bunyan, and I was deputy head and then head of the Police Committee Support Unit, as it was commonly called, although generally referred to as the Police Monitoring and Research Unit as well. And I was there from July 1981 until March 86, when the GRC was shut down. But then I continued to have the same job as head of the unit when the London Strategic Policy Unit was founded, which was a continuation of certain key research units, which went on for a further 2 years. It went on from April 86 until March 88.
So my reason for talking to you today, Tony, is because having discovered that you worked at the GRC, especially in the police monitoring, was to track the history of police monitoring from the offices in the GRC to then the progress on the ground, so the people that got the shop fronts to do the monitoring themselves, and then which boroughs and where it took place. And my interest is just to see that progression, see what happened, what's happened since, and how it all came about. And I'm hoping that in our discussion I can get your personal history of how you came to the GRC and how you came to work for the policing unit, yeah. And then your thoughts on after. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Find that question. So the first thing I want to ask you is how you came to the GRC in the first place.
This was the summer. The election was in the May 81. And before it in Brixton and after it in the June. So you've got this period when the election was in May, but before it and after in June, you'd have what were known as the riots, in quote. Riots not being a pejorative term, but being a term to express people protesting at their condition and the way they've been treated by the police. And in the second of those occasions, we actually monitored, when I was, I'll go back to this later, working for state research. We monitored that in fact there'd been uprisings, as we called them at the time, in 26 different cities. In other words, it didn't just happen in London. It happened in different parts of London. It happened again in Brixton after the earlier one in the year. And it happened in Brixton again, but it happened in Hackney where I live, so on the same time people were rebelling. It happened in 26 different cities, in Manchester and Bradford and Leeds and Birmingham and Cardiff. So there was a particular context in which the GRC election came through, and Ken Livingston went there with others like John McDonnell. John Kennedy was obviously leader of the council, and John was head of the Finance and General Purposes Committee, which is obviously a very powerful committee. And I've been working for state research for four years, and needed to move on partly because we'd run out of money, but it carried on for a couple of years after that. and I applied for the job of deputy head of the unit. I wasn't expecting to get it, I mean, because it was a rather grand new thing, because I mean, it was, the old GLC was very stuffy and very, it was doing a job for people in London, but it was doing it in a rather stuffy way, a traditional way, back to the old London County Council. In fact, that's interesting. Where did the boundaries of London, how did they get drawn? They were drawn up on the basis that it, when Metropolitan Police were founded in 1829, but its boundaries were up on the basis how far could a horse travel in a day? And then they amended it, so that's why it's sort of a circle, but it's not a circle, because of the different terrain that the horses had to go over. If you could think of what the GLC looks like, or the GLA looks like, yeah. It is a kind of circle. And that was how they drew the boundaries of the old London County Council. And so I applied for it, and I went for the interview. I didn't know either Paul Brightangle, who was the chair of the Police Commission Support, who had just been set up. It was a new committee. There wasn't a committee on that issue, like there wasn't one on the race committee. That they didn't, the economic units, and so all those three were like new. And they came in and said, we want to do this. But of course, they didn't have all they had was the staff that had been there for the previous 15, 20 years, and like a research department, which was very straightforward and, you know, believed in objective research, and, you know, it was a. So. They decided to do it. They took the initiative to create certain extra committees because of the concern that they had already. I mean, there is a history to this, because quite before, we'll come back to it, before 81, you'd had in 79, you'd had the death of Blair Peach at the hands of the Special Patrol Group in Southall. So this didn't come out of, what happened in 81 didn't come out of the blue. There was a whole history to it. Anyway, they decided that, and there was a job was advertised. I went for the job. I didn't know Paul Bastig at that time, or Steve Bundred, who was the vice chair. They were both new councillors.
What were their names, sorry?
Paul Boateng, Boateng, who was solicitor with Bernberg Pierce.
Mm.
Well, it might have been Bernberg at the time, but what we now know as Bernberg Pierce. And he worked not in their Camden office, but in their office down in near London Bridge. So we were all new to it in a sense. A lot of the Labour councillors were new, and certainly then they had that they obviously had to do all the traditional functions in terms of education with the ILEA, and they had to do the housing functions and the environmental functions. You know, there were things which had to go on anyway, regardless who was in control. But they decided, in fact, it was time to actually try something different. At the personal level, and I went for the interview. One of the other people who went for the job at the same time, rather ironically, was Martin Kettle, who's now a leader writer on the Guardian, who had been started the Old State Research, but had left it in actually around 81, actually, just before this. And
so had you worked together with Martin Kettle on State
Research? Well, I was like the coordinator, although I didn't have that title on State Research. Because we ran it as a sort of group, but in fact it was four or five of us were in the office, two at a time, and other people were doing it voluntary. It was a bi-monthly. And... Are you both off? Can't stand this noise. So I remember that I went back after the interview to a council meeting at the Institute of Race Relations, because I was on the council of Institute of Race Relations since 72.
Mm-hmm.
And during the meeting, after about an hour of the meeting, the phone rang and Hazel went to the phone and picked it up and said, Tony, it's for you. So I went over the phone to the phone and they, hello, is that Tony Bunyan? Yes. And so we said, we'd like to... It was the same day I'd done the interview. I'd done the interview in the morning and they were coming back in the afternoon. So it was, you know... So I said, and I remember putting my hand over the thing, and I looked at the room and I said, what do you think? And I said, take it. And I said, yes, that would be nice, so that would be good. What happens now? Well, we'll send you a letter, you know. And of course, things, a letter duly arrived. And then there's a bit of a silence. But in fact, because things were changing, people started getting in touch, and somebody, Paul, said, come in and meet us and whatever. Right, he said, now we've got Martin Ellis has been who founded Amnesty and worked in Liberty as well, NCCL.
Martin, who's that?
Martin Ennals, Martin Ennals, who died a bit after, which, at the end of the GLC of cancer. But he was actually serving his notice in another job in, I think, in Geneva. So they said, right, you're deputy head. We need to find some staff for you. It was literally like that. So they'd got a budget already. They were trying to imagine they'd only been in May, you're in June, and there was just the beginning of July. And they said, well, you've got to appoint other staff. So we need an administrative officer. So I had to find a ministry officer. Very good, excellent woman called Judy Ware. And then they had to recruit two lawyers and three researchers. Now, the researcher job was interesting, because here I was, and I wasn't on the payroll at this stage. I mean, 2 or 3 weeks had gone by, but I mean, it was quick, yeah? And I knew I got the job. But they said, well, we're advertising. So, and I remember sitting in a room right near the top of the GOC main building, on my own, with 346 applications to become one of the GOC researchers, because people were excited by what was going on, and hence, instead of getting maybe 100 applicants, we got 346 applicants. So I sat in this room, and I went through all of them, and I whittled them down to 40, then to 20, and then I took the 20 to Paul and Steve and said, because that's how things work, so they wanted to work closely with the officers, not at remote hands-off.
Who,
yeah?
Were Paul and Steve,
Paul Butting and Steve Undred, yeah? I mean, they were the chair and vice chair. So I said, well, These are the people I've whittled it down to, and we then got that down. I can't remember, probably to a short list of five, and I can't remember who did the interviews on that one. I think I did it with someone from the research department, because they still wanted to keep a handle on it. So it was like, I was the new political, in quotes, appointee brought in, but there was a traditional staff with a certain role in terms of research, and we were meant to be doing research at that stage, yes? I mean, you know, we didn't immediately talk about police monitoring, we were talking, that was the background, but it wasn't. So I had little battles with I can't remember the man's name, the head of that section. But Paul had made it clear that I was to be, if there was any dispute, then I was to have the final say on who should get the jobs, yes? And so we appointed three researchers, and we appointed two lawyers. The two lawyers we appointed were Courtney Griffiths and Louise Christian. They left later, but other lawyers came in. So there we had a minimal staff of Martin wasn't there still, Judy was there. We'd appointed two lawyers, appointed three research people, but they all had different levels of notice to give in or whatever. And then so Judy and I went off and tried to find offices, and we got some rather splendid offices. But then they decided no, we were there for about 6 months. Then it was decided we had to move upstairs, so we moved upstairs where we were next door to the race unit, which was nice because Herman Uzi was running that, and I knew Herman anyway. And so we were right at the top. If you look at the GLC across the river, in the top right-hand corner was the police unit. I can still look at it now and say, oh, that was where I was working. And then slowly things came together. I mean, I do remember very early on, again before I was on the payroll, being contacted by John Carr, who was the Labour chair of the Star Committee. People were very concerned about whether they were being bugged or not. Because it was an atmosphere of, you know, I mean, this is Thatcher's in power, 79 Callaghan got defeated in the election, so, you know, we're in an atmosphere of, and we had private armies running around in the 70s and all kinds of, so there was a general sense of, so I managed to find somebody who was an expert and came in, and they were very pleased, but, you know, it was, in a sense, it was informal, but it had to be done quickly. You couldn't sort of mess around. So we moved out there. Eventually we ended up with about 24 staff. That might sound a lot, but compared with the, I think the race unit was 70 or 80 people, and I think the economic unit was something like 150, 200. So we were the smallest of the new units. In a sense, that was a strength, because we could hold staff meetings with 24 people, yes? Yeah. I mean, not everybody would come, but I mean, it's a manageable number, but you've got 100 people, you can't possibly... You've got to have a much more... Well, ours was a hierarchical structure in terms of decision-making, but if you've got 100 people, you've got to have much more devolution of responsibility, and the heads of sub-units would have to meet together, so... That was quite good about it. So we got... Assistant Martin had a secretary.
What made you, just going back, yeah. What made you want to apply for the job in the first place?
I'm trying to think why. Well, what, you need to get back in my history then. Remember that I had, in my own history, skipping lots of things very quickly, I'd been gone to drama school at a very exciting time at the Central School of Speech and Drama, and trained stage manager. I spent a couple of years with ABC Television down in Twickenham, but didn't really like that bit of the world. I then became the National Youth Officer for the Young Liberals, which was actually very radical at that time, in fact, one of the most radical youth movements in the country, during the anti-apartheid Vietnam War marches, which I'd all been part of, where the Young Liberals had been founding members of the Revolutionary Socialist Students Federation and the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign. And then I started the Agit Book column in Time Out in 1969.
What was the
Agit
Book column?
Well, the Agit Book came about because I got to know Sheila Rowbottom and John Hoyland, and I met them at a happening, as Sheila recalls, in Upper Street in Islington. And we got talking and chatting, and it was street theatre and... like you doing the line drawings and lino cuts and print workshops and, you know, all that thing, kind of thing was happening. And what I was into and what John Hoyland was into was actually trying to map where were all these left groups, where were the bookshops, where were the groups, how do you somehow give the great activity on the ground some kind of voice or some kind of focus. So John used to have a card index of where the groups were. We had out of London groups as well, like national groups, but I mean, it was London and national. And I remember going on to see Tony Elliott in Princedale Road in West London and suggested to him, this was a famous road, we were released for base with Caroline Coon and Felix Dennis with Oz, and it was the road where all the left alternative media were, not all of them, a lot of them are based. And so, yes, yeah, so I got paid £2 a week and I did a weekly column of political activity in London. I started out doing that.
And why was it called Agitprop?
Agitational propaganda. Simple. I don't know the original term. I'm sure it wasn't original. It must have come historically from somewhere else. But, yes, yeah, so Agitprop, later on, was an Agitprop bookshop and various other things came out of it. And then when just after Time Out went weekly, then Tony said, would I like to go and work there as a newbie editor with another guy called David May, so who was, you know, from a local paper he was, whereas I come from a more political background. And so, yes, for two and a half years, I was news editor, one of the news editors of Time Out, during which time we got into investigative journalism, we were covering all kinds of trials and, you know, and it was making news. I mean, we were breaking ground. So in a sense, and also I was working with Insurance Relations and doing work there, and on state research, we've been publishing stuff on all kinds of things to do with race and policing and things. So in a sense, I had the background, and I think that's what, why in a sense they had that combination of Martin, who was quite a well-known figurehead, not just a figure, but some well-known person in the field, whereas I was the person who was actually right on top of what was. And also, what I've left out of this, in 1976-77, I wrote a book called The Political Police in Britain, which was the hardback reprinted once and the paperback reprinted three times. So, and that became a sort of standard piece of work. So that was so Paul and people just knew that I'd written that book, and they knew I was part of state research, they knew I was part of the institute. So that was a good person to have a deputy head, not the thing. I always remember that there was a cutting in the Evening Standard where they had this gossip column in the Evening Standard, and they said the main story of this particular day, I still got a copy of it at home, is, look at that GLC, they've appointed this man, Martin Eddowes,
who's been running all these radical rights organisations, and he's going to get X amount times a year, and then his deputy is even worse, so it's Tony Bunyan, who's written that political piece in Britain, he's done this, and he's going to get that. At which we were watered us back, and we were right at the beginning of the job, and yes, it was the most money I'd ever earned in my life, but then it turned out to be the time where the most I ever did earn in my life, you know? So that's why I saved quite a bit of money. Because I didn't want to get used to living on too much. So this was it. This was a sense, but also a sense, because then if you walk around and went to the canteen, you would suddenly bump into Sheila Redbottom and bump into Hughie Wainwright and John Royle and the people there. All old friends that had gone to work, they were mainly in the economic unit. So, you know, there were other friends who were going in. We didn't meet to discuss it. We just did it, if that made sense. It's partly because the 70s, looking backward, you're going to see this was the high point and the ending of that period of hope. But we had all come through 67, 68. I mean, Hillary I'd known from 65. Yeah, 65, 66. And we'd all come through that period of hope, out of the Vietnam marches, out of the what we called the extra parliamentary movement, out of what was the women's movement emerging, and the race unit and the black movement emerging, and the gay movement emerging, and a sense also of having a sense of internationalism, not just being narrow Englanders, but Europeans and internationalists. So that was a period of That was a period of hope, that things were possible, another world is possible.
And you saw the GLC as a...
So the GLC, in a sense, then this opportunity came along to actually move into the biggest local authority in the country, and with some exciting people, there were exciting new ideas, and to bring people in, and then to actually try and make a difference. Who's that horrible term? We didn't use that term at the time. I'm sure Tony Blair invented that. In fact, I'm certain he made that point. So everything's possible. I mean, what we did have to do, though, quite quickly, which was good, very good, is that Martin and I, the initial appointments, as I say, were done the chairs and vice chairs had to take the decisions over who was appointed or work with me or me in terms of who was appointed. But then we had to, that autumn, we had to go on 4 or 5 days equal opportunities training, which wasn't just training, it was training in the idea of equal opportunities policy, but also equal opportunities recruitment. I mean, the two go together. So that was really interesting, because we had people, Martin and I went on different days, which was a good idea. But there we were, you know, with people from housing and from economics and education and whatever, were from different parts of the GLC. So in a sense, that was interesting for us to get to meet people who, in this vast organisation, 22,000 people, I think, you know, who had different jobs to you and different perceptions. Most of whom were in favour, but some of whom were a bit doubtful, whereas I was on the side, this is what should be happening. So in a sense, the GLC, one of its early achievements was to set those standards for local government of equal opportunity training and recruitment, and that became, I'm not saying less word for word, but became much more of a standard throughout local government and has stayed ever since.
And so did that affect who you employed when you chose your researchers, or was that after?
No, in terms of recruitment, it was defining a procedure. You know, that you had to have people doing the interviews who themselves had been equal opportunity trained, that everything had to be written down, so you'd list all the people, you'd have to make sure everybody who applied got all the information, you'd have to make, like we've actually run it since in State Watch, because three of us connected with State Watch worked in local government. In fact, when Nadine was around, there's four of us who'd worked in local government. But a procedure so that you actually had a way of scoring. So you would, if there was three on a panel or two on a panel, then you would each independently look through the application that would score them against the essential and desirable criteria. And then you would come together and you would agree how to get that down to five people. But you'd each done your own independent marking. Yeah, so... And when you do the interview itself, you start again. That's all in the past. You have to, again, each evaluate on essential and desirable criteria where the other person scores. So it was introducing something which was formalising something, which was turning an idea into a practice, which was good. But by this time, of course, we're getting into 82, and so now budgets are starting to appear, so you've got the staff there. And so the staff, in a sense, especially in the units like ours, which are small, did have a definite say alongside the chair and the vice chair together, because we all got on well together, you know, about, well, what should we be doing? You know, obviously our job is to monitor London Police, but I mean, how were we going to monitor London Police?
Had there been anything like that before?
No, I mean, obviously, historically, going way back, there have been individual protest movements against a particular action, or short-lived ones, and Liberty has obviously been around a long time, NCCL. But there hadn't been anything like it before, certainly local government. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was a question of saying, well, what do we want to do? So in the end, we were producing... Well, the lawyers were clearly advising on what we were writing, and writing themselves, and researching, and... looking at the legal aspects of what the police were doing, what reaction were the police, and the researchers were obviously looking at the background. But what we came down to in the end, we obviously had to produce committee reports, which could be on issues, or as it turned out later, could be on grant making to local monitoring groups, and grant making for research. The monitoring turned out to be the most important side, but it didn't mean to say we didn't give money where somebody said they wanted to do research on a particular subject. And that was all allowed under Section 1, I think it was 127 or 132 of the Local Government Act, one of the powers they discovered very early on. A little known power, which meant you could spend money on things which weren't nothing else covered.
Oh.
That makes sense, yes? But that was used by the whole of Labour administration to actually spend money on things they wanted to spend money on, because it wasn't covered. The committees hadn't existed before, for example. So we were going to do research, and then because I'd come from that background of doing state research, which was a bi-monthly, I said, look, we need a way of reporting what is going on so that people around London, we can provide, not daily news, but we can provide news. So we did it. Policing in London was a bi-monthly.
And that was a magazine?
Yes, it was a bulletin, like our bulletins. Mm-hmm. There were copies downstairs, which we must remember to take with us, and I've still got sets of them, mm-hmm. A set at home. So that was called Policing London. That was its name, Policing London. And we're going to write reports, like we did quite soon after we came in. We did a report into the Scarman inquiry, which came out of the riots of 1981, but we were saying, well, what was good about Scarman, and what was bad about Scarman, and what needed to develop out of Scarman. So we had a concept of community policing, which was different to what became later. It got co-opted in a sort of Thatcherite way to mean community policing is what the police did, whereas our concept of community policing was actually of a different concept of a different kind of police force, which was more accountable to actually people on the ground. So we did a report on police complaint system, the Irish community later, I dig them out somewhere, we did quite regular reports, but then we're doing committee reports on issues, and every time we gave out a grant, we had to put that through committee, so that was the whole process. You'd have to see the group, decide it, or criteria, the lawyers would have to look at it. The finance people would have to look at any proposal within the GLC, who were the more traditional departments, yes? There's a story about that I'll tell you in a minute. And then obviously the monitoring groups was the most contentious one, because this came the idea, because you already had, out of Southall, you've got the Southall Monitoring Group, SMG, with Sir Rich Grover, who is now the London Monitoring Group. And I think, I'm pretty certain at that time, you quite quickly, or you had there already, and I'd have to check on this, I think you had a newer monitoring group as well.
And these are already existed?
They certainly Southall pre-existed. And it might not have had the name South or Monitoring Group at that time. I could dig that out in my history of the 70s. But they were models in a sense. They were what could be done by local people organising to try and make, bring the police to account, and by having on the spot legal advice to help people defend, you know, get called out at night, and people could go and help people. People could learn things about the facts about the police, or if something happened, they would become places where people organised protests against what was going on. Because you had, when Monitoring Group was running, you had a shop front office. That was the whole idea. There was a shop front with anything from 2 to 4 or 5 staff, depending on the borough, depending on the borough's history. And I think in the end there were 20 out of 32 boroughs had monitoring groups.
And
The story, it is worth telling and putting on record, because it was very early on. It was probably that autumn, or maybe the following spring of 82. I think it was spring of 82. We had some grant coming. I can't remember particularly who it was for. It could have been a monitoring group. Anyway, the legal people, Mr. Fitzpatrick, head of the legal service, which is a big department in the GRC, obviously, and the finance people, weren't quite sure they liked it. Maybe it was the first monitoring group coming up. I can't remember precisely. Anyway, they decided they didn't like this at all, and they threw up lots of objections, and their notes came back to... I can't remember why this happened. It must have, actually, you know, it must have happened quite early on, because I was thinking, did they come back to Martin? But no, I was the person, so it must have been very early on. It must have been 81, when they said that they couldn't approve it. So I rang up Paul. He made it quite clear that I could ring him up whenever I wanted to, yes? Or if he wasn't around, I could ring Steve, yeah? And I said, Paul, they're not happy with this. And I said, you know, they're saying we can't do it. He said, right, Tony. He said, I want them all in my office at 4 o'clock. This was just after lunch or something. So there I duly appear, in my informal clothing. And I had a jacket and a red tie to put on for committees later on. That's another story. How did Tony get his red tie? But I was in my shirt and pullover. But I was smart, you know. But I mean, you know. And there was this long line of besuited men, so anyway, I could refer to, because most of them I didn't know from Adam. So I stayed at the head of the queue, and Paul arrived, and he said, right, and they weren't allowed to go into the room until he came, because that was the etiquette, so the councillor had to go in first, especially chair of a committee. So Paul went and sat down, we all filed in, and Paul sat at one end, and I sat at the other end. And he said, right, so he told me, what's the problem? There's all these men. So I said, well, the following is the problem. I said, there's this and this. You know, I was instructed by you to do this, and Steve, we've drawn up the papers, we've had our own admin people look through it, our own lawyers look into it, but when it's gone out to these people, they give this reason and that reason why that they say that we can't do it.
And these are other departments in the
GRC? Yeah, but mainly finance and legal. So Paul listened to me. He said, right, Tony, yes. And he looked at this and said, what's your problem? I think one or two of them tried to desperately defend their decision. But the upshot of it was that they were being told by the committee chair they didn't have any financial or legal grounds for stopping the thing going forward to committee. And so it must have been in that autumn. So one minute you don't know what you're going to do in the world, then you get a job there, then you're interviewing 6 people, then you're recruiting people, and then you're telling the whole hesitancy. But the important thing was, and it must have been that autumn of 81, we were laying down a marker that we weren't daft, that we had people in our unit who did know what the law was. We'd done our homework properly. We knew what was possible. And we weren't going to be told by them we can't do it for reasons which didn't make sense. And after that, we had no problems. We got an occasional comment, of course, but we cleared it. And I think other units had to do the same thing, I think a bit later than us. Yeah, the new units, yeah, because they were trying to block what they were doing.
So how long, so you got the first couple of monitoring groups that took the bar?
They were there before, yes, and they were obviously funding, you go to them, and then, but then we were funding other groups like Runnymede Trust and other groups, you know, they wanted to do a project, so we would fund that, or the race unit would fund it, yes, depending on what the subject was. It was policing, it would be us, it was race, in general racism, then it might be the Herman's unit, race unit. And So through 82 and 83, things were really quite exciting, and it was growing, and we were doing lots of work, and Police in London was coming out. 84 was the police bill, when we famously produced a video, hip-hop video, saying, with the title, Kill, Kill the Bill, which got passed the legal department. Sure, we had our tongue in cheek, but
that's great.
But of course, by now that you could hold meetings. You see, not only was this happening, but also, this is also important. Although we were funding the monitoring groups, the Labour boroughs were setting up borough police committees. This is the thing I didn't mention before. Yes. So you've got a structure. You've got the GLC unit at the top. You've got monitoring groups growing up, which are independent community, but at the same time, you had progressive Labour councils, and often, sometimes in support of Liberals too, setting up committees at the borough level. Police committees at the borough level. And I think it was very similar. I think it was something like 20 to 24 actually had, maybe a bit less, maybe 15 or 16 had borough police committees. So you're beginning to get an infrastructure being created. So things would happen in Camden, in the Camden unit, or happen in the Islington unit, police committee, and they'd CC to Martin Ennis or Tony Bunyan at the DLC, so we had coppers knowing what they were doing. By the second, third year, you were beginning to get this. There was a lot more being done on the ground than was done at the top, in a sense, which was exactly what you wanted to happen. And then the boroughs weren't controlling the monitoring. This is a good point. The boroughs were independently being funded by the GLC. They would work with the borough police committees, but they weren't under their control, which was a very important thing to do, because otherwise things could have gone wrong. I'm not sure we consciously, no, I don't, we didn't consciously think that these things just happened. And it wasn't until 84, 85, over the row over the London Transport Fares, that Maggie Thatcher started to put us up, because the GLC would have a flat fare across the whole of London, rather than the Tory government said, no, you've got to charge by the distance travelled. And that issue was chosen by Maggie Thatcher to say, right, we're going to get rid of the GLC, they won't do what I'm telling them.
But there have been a lot of things leading up to that she wanted to...
There were other things that were upsetting them, but the thing which really got their goat was the fact that having been told you couldn't do it, the GLC did it, and then they were told you couldn't do it again, and they said, right, this is... And all lots of other things were happening, and they didn't like police units and whatever, because, When the demonstration happened in Wapping, I think that was 83, 84, the print worker strike, where the police were... I mean, I had our office contacts, got the Retro Police, and say, please can I come along and watch all the police videos of what's been happening? And I was allowed to sit in a room on my own, making notes and watching the police videos, which was interesting, but you had that... authority, yeah.
And you were looking at those videos to see if they had...
Well, I wanted to see what... Yes.
If they were doing anything wrong.
Yes, exactly, you know. I mean, what is it they were basing their actions on and saying people were themselves rioting, or was it the police that were in the problem? So later on, in 84, 85, I was the person sent up by the GLC to liaise with these striking miners in Derbyshire and Yorkshire. And came back and wrote two long reports for the GLC. I mean, other bits of the GLC were doing other things. I mean, they were helping organising convoys of lorries to take up clothing, convoys of lorries to take up food and whatever. But obviously our particular job was actually to say, well, what's happening on the policing grounds? So obviously I was based in Leeds and borrowed a car so that I could drive around. And also the other important thing was because I'm in the NUJ, I kept up my NUJ membership, which was important, but there was Police in London, which I was working on, so I was still doing journalism, and the rule was, providing my NUJ fee was higher than my NALGO fee, then that was all right. So that was very useful when you're going through police lines, because you can't just say, I am from the GLC, but if I can show them a press card, then they would... And that didn't stop something happening to you, necessarily, but I mean, not that it did to me, but I mean, it just meant you had authority. Mm-hmm.
I wasn't having to appear as the lefty GLC coming on, I was going there as a journalist coming on there. Go on, you were going to ask a question.
So between those years that you were in the unit for, when there were things that were found out by local units about what the police had done, how would that get back to you?
Well, I mean, get back to, we would get, I mean, what it was myself and Martin and firstly Lewis Christian and Courtney and then three researchers, that's about seven of us. And we shared those out amongst the staff to be responsible. So we'd each have a project and a couple of monitors to look after. So there was, again, we wanted a link between two were doing pure research, also making sure that the staff got involved in what was happening on the ground, yeah? This came out of practice, yes? I mean, and this was good. So, I mean, one of mine was Hackney, because I lived in Hackney, for example, you know, and somebody else living somewhere else, but everybody had two or three either monitoring groups or projects that they were, and they'd be reporting back through a meal to Martin and on about what's going on. We didn't need to report it back, this was a problem, you know, in a sense. So yeah, that was the way it was evolved. I mean, how do we hear about it? Because they would send stuff in. A couple of meetings were held in the GLC. I mean, on general subjects, which policing was one of the subjects, and therefore we would be contributing to that group. So, I mean, they opened up. In general, they opened up County Hall for community, for groups to come and meet there and do things. And there was concerts there, and all kinds of things were happening, which had never happened before. So it was a new kind of local government, not just at the police monitoring level, but around the whole culture of the place. If that makes sense, yeah. You know, but you've got this sort of things which you have, because I was in Barlow, it's chief officer, and then they called them senior officers, because I was head of the unit, and I was therefore entitled to things, so I could ring up and get a card, come and pick me up at home, and take, I mean, I did it, only used it once, because I actually did have to do work in Ealing, and get to a meeting in the centre of London. There was only one occasion when I used a car, and I said, this is nonsense. If anything that much, I'm going to get a taxi and I'm going to claim it. I'm not having this. It's like when Martin Enos left for another job to start International Alert, and I became head of unit. And Sheila was my secretary, and they said, lovely. I mean, we've got them all together, Sheila and Sharon. I said, look what I want. I said, I want to offer it slightly differently, because I mean, I'm not really used to having a secretary. I mean, you know, but on the other hand, that's their jobs. So I said, what I want you to do, both of you, is to go through training so you actually can get more management experience, you can get more background, so that when the GLC comes to an end, this was a time when it was possibly could be coming to an end, you know.
And when was that? When did you get the feel that it was?
84 into 85, yes. But certainly by the end of 85, obviously, things were being wound down. So it's a relatively short period of time when you think about it. It's 81 to 82, 82 to 83, 83 to 84. 4 to 5 is just about all right, but in the last 6 months was a rundown, yeah? So, and then I'm in, the story of why my attorney's got a red tie. I went into one committee that, was it finance? It's a funny committee. It wasn't finance for general purposes, that was John. It was another committee, a standard committee, like general affairs committee or something, and I gave a report on something, and the guy in the chair was an old-fashioned Labour person, and I stood up to give my talk, and he looked at me and said, "Oh, Mr. Bunny," I said, "I thought police officers wore ties and suits." And I just looked at him, I don't know what to say, so I didn't. So I bought a red tie and just, and only used it to go to that committee. I still got it. But this, you know, there was an element, a very small element in the Labour group, which was from the old Labour, in those terms, yes? Who didn't quite go along with, but they had to, because that's what their locus was, you know what I mean?
Oh, so there were people within
the... One or two. I mean, it wasn't many, maybe four or five of them, but they would chair one committee and chair another committee, so... But that was all managed, you know? Mm. And there was two or three Liberals there. In fact, there was a Liberal there who... I can't remember his name, I can see his face, who I'd known previously, you know, when I'd been National Youth Liberal years before. Mm. And he was a progressive Liberal and lots of things. He represented Richmond and Twickenham, but so, you know, there were some things where he would support what we were doing,
and some of the Tories wouldn't, and the odd Labour person wouldn't. So you always had to be sure what's going to go into committee was going to get through committee. You know? I remember at the end of it, at the end of the GLC, Ken gave a little party, because I hadn't been invited to the end of GLC Jamboree. That's another story. But Ken was there, and I said to him, we didn't see much of you on Police Committee, Ken. He said, no, he said that because you did a good job. You didn't need me to be there in other committees, partly because of the subject matter and the Tories being more stroppy or something was happening, he had to spend more time on them. Anyway, that was a compliment, yeah? But on another side to it, I went to Bramshill to speak a couple of times, the police college, and I think I did it once before I went to GLC and once afterwards to GLC. But then also I became advisor to the Association of Metropolitan Police Authorities.
So what did that
entail? Well, the Association of Police Authorities was like a local government organisation of all the big cities. In other words, it was London, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, Newcastle. Yeah, I mean, it was all the big urban cities had a committee called the Association of Metropolitan Police Authorities. It was much more encounters, they were called at the time. And that was quite good, because it meant that I got access to getting much more of a national picture then. Yeah, and I had a right to see all the committee papers and what was going through. You know, and it was useful, and I did that even when I went doing LSPU, which is after GLC, and then for the 2 years I was in Haringey, I also had that role of being an advisor to the police.
What
kind
of issues would you
do? Well, they would be getting a lot more stuff like Home Office circulars and things like this, which we weren't necessarily getting at GLC, so it was another source of information, it was another source of experience, and certainly when you got through to the miners' strike, then there was then I had some understanding. Can you find out what's happening with the police support units here? And I had contacts I could get in touch with in different cities, who was going up to the Yorkshire coalfields, who was going to Derbyshire coalfields. So it was useful, yes. And I was seeing another side of it, another side of local government in a sense. So look, some of it was boring, but it was also interesting, you know. And so through that, I would often manage to obtain, and I still got some of them. In fact, some of them in the archive, when we were going out to Mayday Rooms, would come with us. Well, that's where the Miners' Strike GLC archive is now. But for example, I would get the printouts of which police support units, these are normal policemen who are being sent on public order duty, yeah? Were being sent into Yorkshire and Derbyshire and Nottinghamshire. So I would get acquired a list of, who was sending what. Now, that could have been very useful in some trial situations, which sometimes will pass on, but some police ever hit you in the head, and those times, there's hundreds of them, you don't know where they're from, because they come from 20 different forces. But if you knew which forces were in on the day that something happened to somebody, then you could point the finger and say, no, it's no good, because they weren't all wearing numbers at the time, and things like that. Lots of things were going on at this time, there wasn't the numbers. On police officers' uniforms, the police officers' cars. So those were campaigns that had gone through. So it was exciting. It was exciting. I mean, the GLC certainly was exciting. LSPU was still quite exciting because by then things had got a bit embedded. But really, that was the. And then I went to Haringey Police Unit, Police Support Unit. But really, by 88, without the GLC backing, without the backing of London Barrage with me, police committees were slowly trying to be shut down. Yeah. I mean, the thing about the Associated Metro Police Officers, remember, outside of London, they were the police authority. Sorry, I've left that out. These people on the AMA, they were the chairs of the police authorities in all the major cities in England. You know, so that was, they were in charge of big budgets themselves, and they were responsible for providing that the police could be run efficiently and had the sufficient budgetary resources. They weren't meant to have power and policy. Mm-hmm. But however, when things started to happen, like Margaret Simon was chair of the Liverpool one, she made it very clear what she thought about police racism, and she said so, and she, you know, she did it very nicely and very reasonably, so that began to have an influence on what the local police could do and what was acceptable. So you have somebody who was really articulate, who would actually take on the police and come out and then things went wrong. So yeah, I mean, in two or three of the cities, they were really quite important people. I mean, certainly in Manchester. Manchester was the only other out of London metropolitan authority, or indeed borough, that had a police committee, which Steve Wright was head of. And famously in 1984, Leon Britton, who was Home Secretary, came up there, and there was a big demonstration on racism. And in fact, the version of the Special Patrol Group, there was a trained paramilitary type police, who were much more paramilitary now than they were then, but I mean, they were still perceived as being paramilitary in those days. And there had been a demonstration against the government and on racism and things like that, and he'd gone in the back door, and there'd been a big riot and things, and people got arrested. And so they set up an inquiry panel into it, and I was on that panel with John Platts Mills, a very famous, who died in his early 90s, lovely man. He was the chair of QC, who was chair of the panel, and I was on it with Keith Ewing, who's now a professor, and another person I can't quite remember. But we did a report into the Leon visit, Britain, you know, in Manchester, which again was quite important and got attention, and has a copy on the shelves or somewhere. So yeah, it was quite exciting times, yeah.
So you said earlier that 20 out of the 32 boroughs had police monitoring units.
Yeah.
So would that include the shop front?
Yeah, it all in the budget. Yeah.
Right.
Some are bigger than others, and some has depending on the local need and the local history, yes. You know, they all had a minimum of 2 people, and some of them had 4 or 5 people, depending on. And they might have gone off and got other money from somewhere else. The local borough might have given them some money as well, you see, not just the GLC. The boroughs could have come in and said, well, we're going to give you some money to support your activity.
And were many local groups using those?
Oh, yes, they were very, very active. And they had to produce annual reports. They had to, you know, I mean, they were all real. You know, they were all real, and they were doing everyday work of being open door for somebody to come in and say, look, can you help me? This has happened to me, or happened to my son, or whatever. And then they say, right, they weren't all lawyers. They might be correct, but they had local lawyers organised to go and represent people and go down to the police station and get the people out. You and me. So they created an extended local structure of their own contacts and lawyers and people who could help.
And
because remember in the 60s and certainly in the 70s, you had the whole concept. I can't remember how many there were. There must have been 30 or 40. Most of the major cities were what called law centres, and these were funded by local government. The whole law centres movement.
And what were they doing?
Well, they were giving legal advice to people on every subject, not just policing, but on social service benefits, pension benefits. Yeah, I mean it was broad. Yeah, but it was a bit like a more radical citizen advice bureau, a bit more in quotes unofficially political with a small p. Yes, not to say citizen advice couldn't do it, but I mean there was that sense of okay, nibble something. You can edit this out.
So. Some of the questions here about the community groups that were funded, questions are kind of looking at who was funded and why, and the kind of things that the funding was for. So I'm guessing that when it came to the shop fronts, it would be funding for the rent, perhaps?
Yeah, to be rented, yeah, to be bought. Well, the rent would have to be reasonable, mm-hmm. And then again, the finance department of GLC would look at it and they thought it was unreasonable. That's all right. I mean, that's a bit too posh.
Mm.
But it didn't happen very often.
And what happened after the GLC with the policing unit, with the monitoring groups?
Well, some of them continued to get support from the local council. In a few instances, but in most instances they had to shut down because they didn't have the money.
Do you know if there are any groups that came from that decided to keep doing it on their own backs?
Say that question again.
Did anyone carry on the monitoring without the funding?
Yes, well, I mean, a lot of the local groups, like Hackney, was Hackney Legal Defence Campaign.
had different names, and there was lots of local individual cases where people were being harassed by the police, you know, virtually every week, and they were, you know, there became campaigns around individuals being to be targeted. So where there was a strength, they continued on a voluntary basis. They'd have a bit of money. Well, they'd do local community centres, because that would all grow up around the time of GLC. There were more places you could meet for free, yeah? So they would continue with just a little bit of money. They didn't have an employee, but they could meet, and they were a local campaign in the traditional sense. Those did continue. They outlived because of that. But they still exist. It still happens. People up in Bradford going on, people involved in them. I mean, even this year recently, you've had cases, obviously, where that had been happening before the GLC and after the GLC.
How did they work? What was the structure?
How did what work?
The committees in the GLC.
Well, all items of finance and most items of policy had to go through the committee, because the policy often involved, it could be just a policy document, but on the other hand, it could be a policy which had some financial implications, or it could be every year we had an annual budget. Clearly that was agreed every year, and we'd have to sometimes say that we want to grow a bit now. I think we probably started off at 20 and we went to 24, or we want to do this, can we have a bit more money? And because we weren't big, we tend to get what we asked for. Yeah, because we weren't asking for millions and millions. We maybe wanted to say, we want to go... last year, we were on £4 million, which is a lot of money in today's terms. I mean, but when we've been £2 million, we just say, well, can we please have another 500,000? Which sounds a lot, but it wasn't in that...
What kind of things would go with that?
Well, we'd just be saying, we want to expand this. We've got the preschool coming up. We need a budget to deal with the preschool that's coming up. The budgets are all stretched, because we're dealing with the monitoring groups. We're funding them. We're funding this. We've got staff costs. The whole thing's come together, and we don't have anything to mount a campaign. Mm-hmm. I mean, policing London meant that the thing coming out every 2 months. You know, it was free to London. That's all they had to do. I mean, think of this. The ability to put adverts into local and national newspapers saying, if you want a copy of Policing London, this is what it's about, just send your name and address in and you'll get a free copy every 2 months. And so we were circulating 25,000. That's a lot. And some of those weren't taking one copy, they were taking 20 copies to put into bookshops and other things. Yeah.
And what kind of information was in that?
We need to find it. We've certainly got them in the basement. Just remind me, we've got to make sure we reserve one set of policing lunches. I know I've got one set at home, but there must be another set here somewhere. In fact, I'm not sure I've even seen it recently.
I think I remember last time we were in the basement.
It might be in one of those boxes.
Does it have a pink cover?
It was straightforward cover, but it had a headline change. Policing London changed different colours for each issue. But that would be terrible if that went out quietly out of existence. It's not in here. It was in our room downstairs. Just double check.
Oh, hang on.
Whoops.
Somewhere downstairs, and I've got a copy at home, it's what's called the GLC Collected Works. I love the term Collected Works, like Marxist Collected Works. So I've got all IKEA reports published in one volume.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah? Historical purposes.
You were an archivist back then as well, then, didn't you?
Oh, absolutely. Always was. Yeah, so it really was... You know, it was exciting and it was quite busy, and it was a good thing that it happened. And it stood as an example.
I mean, when people talk today about, well, how can we do this again? I think you do have to remember the biggest problem was you had a major authority with budget and the political will to create that police committee, to create the support units, to find the budget, to fund the monitoring groups. And unless you've got... I mean, there's only, in a sense, two ways you're going to get money to do a thing like this again. You either got institutional power, in other words, local government, national government, whatever, regional government, or you've got funding coming from foundations, trusts. There's only two ways that funding... I mean, there's a third way, which obviously is how people contribute, but that is important, but it's a small proportion of what a group needs to exist. But if you haven't got money going into these community-based things coming from national or local government, then there's a problem. How much longer are we going to do this? Beginning to feel.
Maybe I could just ask one or two last questions.
What time is it now?
It's 5 to 5.
Definitely time for me to move.
So maybe I could ask a little bit about your personal microphone working. Maybe I could ask some questions on how you felt personally about being in the GRC and if it affected your political leanings or how it encouraged
No, I think it was symbiotic, if that's the right term. I had, this was a period when I was looking at the British state from 1970 going to time out and right through to when I left Haringey in 1990 when state research started. I was looking at the British state. And so... And it's pre-internet. This is an entirely pre-internet period. So you're much more dependent on getting photocopies of things and things being leaked to you in a different kind of way, yeah? I mean, and so I've been doing that. So if you like, the GLC was fitted in the same pattern. I've been a journalist doing it. I've written a book. I'd done a bit of teaching before state research started. And then I got a chance to try to bring those ideas... You know, to a different level. I always remember the irony was the Mr. Dunning, who was the chief honcho on the officer side, used to have these weekly, monthly meetings of all the heads of unit. I never used to go to them. I thought it was boring. Anyway, he took me to lunch two or three times. He was talking about something. So he came back to Martin and said, "Oh, Mr. Dunning is thinking you might benefit from getting more management training. You've got a lot already," he said, "but Unilever were running a course up in so-and-so." And I said, "Martin, when I left school, when I was 19, I was chosen as one of the two schoolboys in the whole of the United Kingdom to train to become fast-track executive directors by Unilever. And I walked away from that after a year. I did it for you. I had to do it because... It was like following my dad, and he worked for Shell, you know, straightforward shirt and tie and suit. And I went to drama school, you know. I mean, I'd done that, but I, in a sense, because I'd done that year there, and then I'd done Young Liberal Management, Young Liberal being National Youth Officer. I mean, I'd had quite a bit of management history, not a lot, but... I sometimes thought that was unfortunate, that I was quite good at managing and quite good at finances. I mean, adding things up and getting...
because it meant I, and the GLC, I was getting a bit frustrated not doing enough hands-on work about the subject matter, so in a sense. On the other hand, I said to myself, well, someone's got to do this job to let other people do it, you and me. So in general, it was fine. But in a sense, at time to time, I felt I had less time to do this kind of research that I was...
What kind of thing would you want
to... I don't know. I mean, you just have more time to... You know, but I mean, it's what I've been doing before, so in a sense, I was moving away from it. That's why I wanted... That's why I left the Haringey, and I wanted to get back to it, and the state research started. State Watch started, rather. You mean, we wanted to get back to getting involved in the subject matter, even if we didn't have money. Does that make sense? Yes. I mean, it was a logical progression. It might seem it was a logical progression. Haringey was about 2 years, but that was in between, and I needed perhaps it been. I mean, one of the things, for example, I mean, I had to, when the GLC was abolished, I had to make sure that everybody who wanted a job in our unit got a job in LSPU.
Right. What was LSPU?
London Strategic Policy Unit from 86 to 88. So I had to make sure that I could fight for a budget, because it was much smaller. It's 300 people instead of 20,000, 22,000. Yeah, so you were talking. It's a research activist side of the GLC. Yeah? So it's only 300 people. Because we were the smallest unit, we managed to keep 24 out of 24. So.
Oh wow.
Yeah, was other units went from 300 down to X, but because we were small, so. Yeah, I mean, I think everybody wanted a job to come on and get a job. And then, of course, when the LSPU was abolished, I had to make sure all those who wanted to get a job in the boroughs could get a job. And I was the last person to get a job to go to Haringey, yeah? So, I mean, that was an important thing to do, to make sure that people had been loyal and worked hard and whatever, actually, if they wanted to, some went off and did other things. But the majority wanted to find other jobs at that stage in local government somewhere, yeah? So yes, I twice had to get people redeployed and make sure they had jobs.
If something like the GLC were to come back now,
yeah,
and they would reinvigorate a policing unit, what advice would you give those people who would be doing that now?
Well, I think I said a bit earlier. I mean, if there was the political will to do it, which was then matched by the funds to do it. Mm-hmm. Then that is precisely the point at which the GLC story becomes relevant to the present.
Mm.
You know, because I can't see it happening next year or the year afterwards. And who knows, it might not happen for 5 years, it may never happen. But when it does happen, people would need to, if they're wise, to look backwards and to learn from the past, you know. I mean, that is why, for example, the London Metropolitan Archive, which I see is mentioned in the GLC story, has got all the official papers. It's got all the committee minutes, the police committee, yeah?
Mm.
What it doesn't have, of course, is it's got all the, it's got, actually got the details of all the monitoring groups. It will. They will be part of a committee report.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have all the research files and everything else in it, because they weren't considered valuable. We've still got some of those. We used to have more. We had to, some of those we've still got with us now. Because we had lots of fun again. I mean, I remember at the end of LSVU, we had 10 four-door filing cabinets, none of which we've got left now. We had 10 four-door filing cabinets, and I said I wanted to buy them and take to state Watch. And I said, how much is that going to cost? No, I bought them from Camden before I went to Haringey. And they said, well, the 10 filing cabinets is about £160 or something. I said, well, what about the contents? Well, that doesn't have any value. So I personally bought the filing cabinets in order to keep the files.
And where are those files now?
We had to lose a lot of them when we moved from Stoke Newington and into here downstairs, because we just didn't have the room.
Mm.
We had a massive index, you know. I mean, it's a lot of stuff, but... You know, what did we give priority? The pamphlets and the books, and then the subject files. Some of them I've just basically retrieved. There's still some downstairs in the basement. I've got to decide what for those to keep. But there comes a time, I mean, you know, several people in State Watch are quite sort of like Steve Pearce's, Anne's, whatever. I'm very much archivist, keeping stuff. which does have a value, because suddenly you've got it to sell it to other people, but at other times, if you just haven't got room for other things to take a priority, then you just have to say that's it. Mm. Shut your eyes and just say, well. No, you remind me. I must make sure we've got our set of piece in London through. I've got a set at home, but I'd like to think there's another set of history. And I've got a set of all the publications we did, which I'm not sure are in here. I might donate them to the, when we're in Maiden and settled, I mean, to the pamphlet library, but when I'm settled, then make sure it's working all right. Is that all right? I think I'm going to lose my voice in a minute.
Yeah, thank you, Tony. That's great. That's really fun.
Click this thing off.